Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deadlocked super committee that has to agree on $1.2 trillion in cuts by Monday to meet the Wednesday deadline before the sequester happens and automatic across-the-board cuts take place. Former six-term Congressman Bob Edgar, who is now head of Common Cause, joins us to talk about our broken Congress, corrupted by lobbyists and special interests, to the point where they have exempted themselves from insider trading laws on stock transactions. We will follow up on whether, as a result of the recent 60 Minutes expose and citizen outrage it provoked, the Stock Act aimed at cleaning up Congress will be revived. Then we'll examine Turkey's more assertive role in the Middle East as it emerges as the best hope to facilitate the removal of the bloody Assad regime next door in Syria, avoid civil war, and help stabilize a post-Assad Syria. Asla Bali, a specialist on international human rights and the laws of war, joins us. We will discuss what motivates Turkey's leader and the behind-the-scenes reasons for Turkey's alienation from Israel and the reversal of its support for the Assad regime. Then finally, Susan Shirk joins us. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and we will discuss President Obama's trip to Australia and the APEC summit in Indonesia and the so-called pivot towards Asia in terms of the Obama administration's new foreign policy doctrine that promises to look more towards Asia and China and away from the traditional primary focus on Europe. Joining us now is Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause, a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit citizens lobby working to make government at all levels more honest, open, and accountable, and to connect citizens with their democracy. Previously, he served 12 years in the House of Representatives for the 7th Congressional District in Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia. He was part of the congressional class nicknamed the Watergate Babies, those elected in the wake of the Watergate scandal, who led to sweeping reforms of Congress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Edgar.
It's good to be with you.
And clearly the deadlocked super committee is, I think, even aides are leaking this. Patty Murray, the co-chair, seemed to indicate that they're not going to come to an agreement, that they're deadlocked because they're evenly numbered Republicans and Democrats. Somebody has to cross the line. And apparently that's not going to happen. Do you think this will mean, and of course, just in terms of technicalities, even though the decision's due by Thanksgiving, they need to come up with it tomorrow. I mean, they need to come up with it Monday in order for the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, to score it to make sure that the figures make sense. So it looks like they're not going to make the deadline. Do you think the across-the-board cuts will automatically come into play?
Well, first, let me say that I think that the super committee was a flawed idea from the very beginning. It was flawed primarily because you have on the conservative Republican side an unwillingness to move on revenues, and on the Democratic side, a need to protect some of the social programs. Your question's a good one. I think that the committee will fail, but when it fails, I don't think the automatic cuts will go into play. For example, they don't go into play until 2013. That gives Congress an awful lot of time to tinker around, and one of the ways they'll tinker is to restore the funds for the defense budget. Conservatives and liberals all have defense contractors in their congressional districts, and money has corroded the political system in which we operate today. So I think the super committee will fail, but I also think the across-the-board cuts will be tinkered with over the course of 2012 before they take place in 2013.
And Bob Edgar, do you think that the Congress, now with record low approval ratings of 9%, and frankly, I wonder who those 9% are, that their ratings will go even lower?
Well, I think before they worry too much about the ratings, they ought to worry about the fact that there's a plague on both parties, and I think all incumbents are going to be in trouble in 2012, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, simply because of the outrage of the people. My hope is that all of the Occupy movements will make a complete shift to occupying democracy, register to vote, get involved in the political process, and that some new people will step forward to run for public office so that there is competition across the board in both the Democratic and Republican parties in 2012. I think we need some new people in office to push for more collaboration, more cooperation. When I served in Congress for 12 years from 1975 to 1987, some of my best friends were moderate Republicans like Jake Javits and Senator Brooks and Senator Hines and Schweiker and other moderate Republicans. Those moderate Republicans have disappeared completely. And when you have the mentality of a Bachman and mentality of a ultra-conservative right-wing policies being pushed with no intention of compromise, you're going to simply see deadlock moving into the future. And America cannot afford that. We've got to address the issues of global warming. We've got to address the issues of jobs and employment. And we're not going to be able to see our Congress really do the right thing until we get elected officials who serve the public interest and not the special interest.
Frankly, I could see a very, very angry electorate in 2012 at the polls, assuming they're not so disgusted that they won't show up to vote.
Yeah, I think the super committee was wishful thinking on the part of particularly the Democrats, who wanted to get away from the deadlock that was occurring in the summer, hoping that if 12 competent House and Senate members spend enough time with each other, that you would see give and take on both sides, both on the revenue side and on the expenditure side. That clearly is not going to happen. I think it would have worked better if the sequestering would have occurred exactly when the super committee failed. By giving a whole year between now and the time that the cuts kick in, all kinds of things can happen with Congress. So I think we're going to see more deadlocks and more change. And frankly, I put the blame on the conservative Republicans who got elected. Many of them got elected on one issue, concerns of abortion and homosexuality and civil marriage. And they're just not up to the task of legislating like many of their colleagues in the past who were Republicans, fiscally conservative, but cared what was in the best interest of the nation. And it was not inconceivable for Republicans and Democrats to put in place the Older Americans Act, Head Start, the First Energy Bill, resource recovery legislation. It wasn't just Democrats that put that in place. Democrats and Republicans working together were able to think beyond their reelections, think beyond party politics, and that simply isn't the case these days.
Again, I'm speaking with Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause. He served for 12 years in the House of Representatives. We're talking about the super committee's apparent inability to agree on the $1.2 trillion in cuts and the extent to which the automatic trigger that's supposed to take place will probably not happen in terms of the Congress having plenty of time to weasel their way out of this enforced agreement. So the Republicans drew a line in the sand on tax cuts, and mostly to do with keeping the Bush tax cuts in play. That's apparently what the real line in the sand and the impasse has been over. Economist Paul Krugman suggested that a failure to come to an agreement would be a good thing, that these cuts would automatically expire. Do you think that that's a good idea?
Well, Paul's very bright, and he has a better handle on economics than I do, and he has been a real champion of saying that the emperor has no clothes and the system isn't working. I think he has more faith in the fact that the automatic cuts will go into play. My own sense is that there's another ingredient that we haven't talked about, and that is the role of money in politics. Since the Citizens United case, a lot of very, very conservative corporations and very conservative wealthy people will have quite a bit of influence and flood the political system with money. And they will try to protect not only the tax system, protecting the wealthy from paying more tax, but they will, my friend Bill Moyer says it best, he says, this is the most dangerous moment in American history. We're either going to be a nation that's of and by and for the people, or of and by and for corporations and the wealthy. And I think that's the danger that we face moving forward. And when you have people like the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, who have infiltrated the political system, have put people on the Energy and Commerce Committee to block all regulations of EPA on clean air and clean water. When you have corporations sitting down with state legislators and national legislators, drafting bills with corporate lawyers in the same room with average ordinary legislative people, you've got a real problem. And no one believed that the day before Citizens United was passed by the Supreme Court that corporations and labor unions didn't already have a role in politics. But now, because of that decision, very narrowly passed by a 5-4 vote, corporations and labor unions can dip into their corporate treasury and spend those on independent expenditures for and against candidates. And I believe that over the course of time, if we don't change that Citizens United case, we're going to find money even a more corrosive influence than it already is.
And Bob Edgar, I think in many ways the recent expose by 60 Minutes that showed how the Congress have exempted themselves from insider trading laws on stock transactions. Not that we needed another reminder of the corruption of Congress, but I think this was particularly outrageous, and I think it provoked a tremendously strong response from the public. It certainly did it to me. I thought I had a pretty high threshold for outrage. But the Stock Act, of course, has been languishing in the House since it was brought in by a Washington State congressman who's no longer in the House. Part of the 60 Minutes report showed how the reporter kept trying to ambush congressmen on the steps to ask them about the Stock Act. They all acted as if they'd never heard of it. Now, apparently, it's starting to get some co-sponsors. What's your understanding of where things stand?
Well, I think the 60 Minutes piece was helpful. It's too bad that so many newspapers and media outlets have done away with their investigative reporting. Fortunately, 60 Minutes and ProPublica and a few other organizations continue to do the investigation. I think it's clear that some members of the House of Representatives and the Senate had, in fact, used inside knowledge to gain massive wealth. Clearly, it's not all of the House and Senate members, but it's significant that a number of them have been caught with their fingers in the cookie jar. And I think the 60 Minutes piece will enable those supporters of the Stock Act to get more co-sponsors on both the House and Senate side. And my hope is that the embarrassment will be so high that congressmen and senators will cross party lines, come together, and support the Stock Act. I would ask them to go even further. I think because of some of what we've seen with Citizens United, we need some better rules and regulations on shareholder rights. We need to allow people to have full transparency of political contributions. And I think if we had more investigative reporting, we'd see even more, not just insider trading, but more control of our elected officials by certain special interests that want to stop legislation to protect the environment, stop legislation to protect a tax system that has shrunk in its ability to get adequate revenues to run our country.
Well, I think, Bob Edgar, what absolutely enrages citizens is that the Congress who make laws that exempt them from following the same laws that us mere mortals have to follow. Yeah. Are there any other examples that you know of apart from this exemption from insider trading?
Well, when I served in Congress, I served on the Public Works Committee, and sitting in the audience every time we had a hearing, every seat was filled, but it was filled with the people who build our highways and our airports, all of the special interest groups. And so, unfortunately, average ordinary citizens aren't able to see the influence of those special interests on elected officials. And when a House member now has to raise $1.2 million to get reelected, and senators in some of the larger states are spending $15, $20, $30 million, even more, to run for the United States Senate, they're not getting that money from average ordinary citizens or citizens in their congressional districts. They're getting that money from special interests. So we're getting the best legislative body that money can buy. And unfortunately, more of that is under the control of special interests rather than the public's interests. I hope that the Occupy movement and some other grassroots movements will begin to help raise the level of visibility about how money is corroding our system. And we can get some elected officials who push not only the Stock Act, but put in place things like public financing of elections so that persons who are not multimillionaires can get elected to the House and Senate and represent their constituents as opposed to representing some corporate special interest.
I thank you for joining us here today, Bob Edgar.
Good to be with you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause, a national nonpartisan nonprofit citizens lobby working to make government at all levels more honest, open, and accountable, and to connect citizens with their democracy. Previously, he served 12 years in the House of Representatives. He was part of the congressional class nicknamed the Watergate Babies, those elected in the wake of the Watergate scandal who led sweeping reforms of Congress. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Turkey's more assertive role in the Middle East.
There's a limit to your love, like a waterfall in slow motion, like a map with no ocean. There's a limit to your love. Your love, your love, your love.
We expected something, something better than before. We expected something more. Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave? Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and she has a forthcoming article on Turkey, The Perils of Judicial Independence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, you're obviously an American citizen of Turkish descent, and you're very much in touch with what's happening in Turkey. Turkey is playing such a leading role now in what's happening in Syria, and many analysts are suggesting it's the new hegemon in the Middle East. How would you describe the emerging role of Turkey?
I think new hegemon is probably not right, but I do think that, even in 2010, before the Arab Spring began, there were numerous articles and meetings and so forth that focused on the emergence of non-Arab regional players as an incredibly important phenomenon in the Middle East, which is to say Iran, Turkey, and Israel. So this is already a phenomenon that had begun, and I think the Arab Spring has in some ways enhanced the role of Turkey while marginalizing to some extent Iran and Israel, and this is a result of the different relationships that these different countries have to the key countries. Turkey is obviously a frontline country with Syria, but one that had good relations with Syria and therefore the potential for leverage. Israel, of course, also shares a border with Syria, but because Israel and Syria have been in a Cold War situation since 1967, there isn't the same potential for Israel to be a player in the region in shaping outcomes. Similarly, Turkey is a country that had a renewed relationship with Egypt at the time that the Egyptian Revolution began. Turkey had very strong ties with Libya at the time that the Libyan Revolution began, etc. So Turkey was positioned in a way as a result of having adopted a foreign policy of re-engagement with the Arab world that began some 5 or 6 years ago under the stewardship of our current foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu. Turkey had already put itself in a position of having extremely sort of prioritized the Arab world as a region with which it was developing very robust policies. And now, as a result of the events that are taking place in that region, Turkey has emerged as an important player, but it really is an outcome of an earlier set of investments. And I'm not sure I would say that those investments are deliberately intended to generate a hegemonic role so much as to actualize an alternative vision of how the Middle East might be organized to the kind of region of conflict model that that had been the case for the previous 40 years. I think Turkey just determined in the course of its sort of failed bid for membership in the European Union that it had better invest in the region that it was located in geopolitically, which is to say not just with respect to Europe, but also the Balkans, also Central Asia, also the Arab world, the Muslim world, Russia, in order to best valorize its own strategic role. And it was in implementing that vision that Turkey has, in fact, I think, generated a much more robust and stable position for itself, in which today the tables have been reversed with respect to the European Union. And I do think Turkey has successfully put itself in the position of being potentially an asset to the Union, as opposed to the way it was seen before, which is sort of a poor relation that perhaps might charitably be included. So it's part of a much broader vision. But I would say that Turkey has emerged, as you suggested, very much as a powerful player in the Arab world at a time of great change in the Arab world.
So Aslan Bali, clearly Turkey has taken, at least Prime Minister Erdogan has taken a very leading role in dealing with Syria in the absence of the other powers, European and United States and the UN. And I imagine the US and Israel have kept their hands off because they don't want to feed into Bashar al-Assad's narrative of foreign interference. But nevertheless, given the current situation where the Arab League gave President Bashar al-Assad until Saturday to start implementing a plan calling for the withdrawal of troops, the release of prisoners, and a dialogue with the opposition. Apparently, the Syrians again reneged on it, largely because they didn't want the monitors that the Arab League wanted to have there. But in terms of taking the lead, Prime Minister Erdogan, you know, has really stepped out, and he kind of owns this situation, recently referred to Bashar al-Assad as feeding on blood. How much of this is this particular man who, when he came on the scene, there was a great deal of alarm that he was going to be some kind of radical Islamist, but he seems to be a man of principle and to be genuinely appalled at what's happening next door in terms of human rights violations?
I agree with that assessment. First of all, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, I think, has been a very interesting character. At different times, I think people, analysts in Turkey, might have compared him to Putin, for example, the Putin of Turkey, in that he has a quite authoritarian streak. He runs the party with tremendous discipline in a hierarchical fashion. He is someone who basically, in many occasions, one has seen him sort of change policies, shooting from the hip, basically. But as he sees a changing context, he essentially changes course abruptly and without much consultation with, for example, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and so on, and that has generated alarm in certain quarters. Others have described him as the Joe Biden of Turkey, if you want, someone who essentially will say things in the spirit of the moment and then leave the rest of the ministries to clean up after that set of off-the-cuff statements that sound like a complete reversal of Turkish policy and so on. But I think that you have really struck the nail on the head with your point concerning the idea of him as someone who has at least a particular moral compass. And I think it's interesting to see how it plays out now. Some might remember that in 2009, after the Gaza war with Israel, in which Israel engaged in a basically aerial bombardment of the Gaza Strip, Recep Tayyip Erdogan took it extremely personally. And this is another scenario in which that's happening. So at that time, in 2009, Erdogan had developed a very close relationship with Ehud Olmert, then Prime Minister of Israel, and had used his own personal capital to try to move forward negotiations between Israel and Syria. And he had asked of both parties, of Israel and of Syria, a particular concession in order to make it viable for the negotiations to continue, which is to maintain quiet on both borders. So from the Syrian perspective, he asked of the Syrian regime that they make sure that there's no activity at all on Israel's northern border, no actions by Hezbollah. And on the from the Israelis, they asked that there be no change at southern border, that is to say, no change of policy or crackdown in Gaza. And they were very successful. They had negotiations. And then Ehud Olmert came to Ankara in December of 2008, had a press conference with Erdogan in which they announced that things were going very well and that they were quite close to an agreement. And it was the first time the two parties publicly acknowledged that Turkey was playing this mediator role and so forth. And 2 days later, the Gaza war began. And Erdogan took it as not only a personal insult and a suggestion that perhaps he was informed in advance that this was going to happen, and all the public records suggest that that wasn't the case. But he also was galled by what was actually being done in Gaza. And he became probably the most outspoken critic of that war, to the point that a few months later in February at Davos in 2009, he had a public confrontation on a stage with Shimon Peres where he stalked off the stage. And actually, that was the circumstance in which he became sort of a heroic figure in the eyes of just ordinary people in the Arab streets, because they saw this as the first time they had seen a leader of the region publicly rebuke in this kind of an open fashion the Israeli leadership. And this was the beginning of the Gaza war, coupled with that incident, was the beginning of the decline of relations between Turkey and Israel. And it was seen as, at the time, many people, particularly in the United States, said, oh, Turkey's turning away from the West. This is, you know, some kind of evidence of the Islamist strategy emerging, and, you know, this is a power play on the part of Turkey and so forth. And people pointed to the fact that, look, Turkey has very warm relations with dictators, and yet it's repudiating Israel. How is it possible? Well, now we have a situation in which, again, someone that Erdogan counted as a personal friend, Bashar al-Assad, is engaging in behavior that, as far as he's concerned, indicates, and he has said this out loud, that he cannot be trusted. No one, according to Erdogan, nobody expects any longer that Assad is capable of meeting either the expectations of his people or of the international community, and therefore the Assad regime essentially is on a road of no return and simply needs to step down. That's the position he's taken. So he's taken an extremely strong position on Syria, and I think it demonstrates, as you suggested, that this is a question more of principle about the treatment of civilians, the idea that you would, open fire on unarmed persons, on demonstrators, on individuals that are just expressing political dissent and so forth, that's unacceptable. So Turkey is also in a position, and sorry, then I will stop, but Turkey is also in a position that puts it in a kind of strong place with respect to Syria in terms of leverage. It's well worth reminding your listeners that Turkey has an extremely large and well-organized military, which is the second largest in NATO, a very long border with Syria, trade relations with Syria. It's popular with the Syrian people. Turkey basically opened the border with Syria 2 years ago in a bid to develop a free economic zone and lifted visa restrictions. And so there's been tremendous amount over the last 2 years of back and forth between northern Syria and southeastern Turkey, with people rediscovering ties. I mean, these are communities that, of course, have long been neighboring and indeed families across those borders. And for basically, most of the 20th century, the border was extremely strict, and it was very difficult for those families to reunite. Now they have been reunited and so forth. So Turkey has a tremendous amount of leverage with Syria, and it's using that leverage now on behalf, it seems, of the Syrian people.
Again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. And clearly, many people are warning now that Syria is poised for civil war. the Free Syrian Army attacked a headquarters outside of Damascus recently of the Air Force Intelligence, who are the main torturers, because Assad's father came out of the Air Force, and they are the enforcers of the Assad family clan that lay claim to the perpetual rule of Syria. Not only has Turkey played a positive role so far in trying to stop the bloodshed and make the Syrian regime change its ways, now that they've given up on it and it was never going to happen by the looks of things, there's a suggestion that Turkey may offer its territory as a safe haven for rebel groups that are engaging now in what looks like a civil war. There's also been suggestions that Turkey could cut off the electricity supply. Let's go forward then, given that Hillary Clinton's already given this regime a death sentence, as has Ehud Barak in Israel. How do you think Turkey's going to manage this transition to prevent a sectarian, bloody civil war? Because clearly the one country that seems to have the most influence in stabilizing a post-Assad Syria would be Turkey.
Yeah. Well, Turkey threatened to cut off electrical supplies, for example, following an attack on its own embassy in Damascus. So although they've been saying a great deal about Syria will pay a heavy price and should stop oppressing its people and so forth, it's actually on very concrete things that threats have been issued. I think the more important thing that Turkey has offered, as you suggested, is first, they have been offering, they've been hosting and offering asylum to not just the Syrian National Council, which is the now grouping of the opposition in Syria, but also they've allowed the leadership of the so-called Free Syrian Army, the sort of insurgent opposition military wing, to be based in Turkey. But at the same time, they have imposed really significant limits on the activities of the FSA, of the Free Syrian Army, making it absolutely impossible for them to engage in military operations at the border or offering them any arms and so forth. I think they are trying to follow a relatively cautious path, despite the strong language that they're using, in which they're hoping not that Assad remain in office. I think they would be in agreement with Hillary Clinton on that point, but that there's a transition that not entails civil war. I think that for Turkey, it would be dire for a civil war to take place in Syria at this time, because obviously it would destabilize dramatically the region, and Turkey paid a very heavy cost for what amounted to a civil war in Iraq for a very long time, basically from 1991 until we, of course, started paying close attention in 2003, but the destabilization of Iraq, the destruction of its economy, I mean, all of those things began as a result of the previous Gulf War in 1991, and the Turkish Southeast paid a very heavy price for that because of trade restrictions, because of the sanctions that had been placed, and so on. And so going in that direction with respect to Syria is not optimal from Turkey's perspective. I think for Turkey, the best outcome would be a transitional outcome. And this is not only because of the fear of civil war and so forth, but also because there's recognition in Turkey, again, because there are relatively strong ties and people in Turkey understand with some level of sophistication the situation inside of Syria, that Assad still remains popular with some portions of the Syrian population. It's not the case that it's the military against the people. We don't have a united and cohesive front of the civilian population of Syria all opposed to Assad the way that, for example, you might have characterized the situation in Egypt. Instead, you have the, of course, Alawite community, which, by the way, there is a significant proportion of people from the same community in Turkey. Something on the order of 15 to 20% of the Turkish population is IDV, which is how we describe Alawites, a similar heterodox sect as the governing sect in Syria. And the same is true in Syria, something on the order of 15% of the Syrian population. And then add to that the Christian minorities, all of whom continue to support Assad, and the business communities, especially in Damascus and Aleppo, and you have a very significant proportion of the Syrian population still supporting the regime, largely because they're terrified of what the alternative might look like. Under those circumstances, I think from Turkey's perspective, avoiding a civil war has to be the first priority, way ahead of thinking about how best to stabilize a post-civil war Syria. I think that would be seen as an apocalyptic outcome. And frankly, I think that probably people in Turkey and in the region that actually borders on or is adjacent to Syria are a lot more cautious than someone like Hillary Clinton, who from a great distance in the United States can issue these death sentences of Assad must go, as she did previously of Gaddafi must go. But at the end of the day, the price for the implementing that decision is paid in the blood and toil of populations very remote from Hillary Clinton's constituency and from, you know, holding American leadership accountable. So I think there is something irresponsible about the way in which these pronouncements are being made. And I would ask, what is Hillary Clinton's model for how that transition is to be accomplished?
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, Aslan Bali, is this a situation where Turkey's rising influence in the region is a zero-sum game vis-a-vis Iran's? Iran clearly supports this regime. They've sent in the Revolutionary Guard Corps and besieged militia to help out with the Syrian security forces, who are clearly absolutely ruthless. So they've got an investment in this regime staying, and as much as Turkey seems to be the main power calling for the regime to end. So tell me about how this is going to affect Turkey's relations with Iran.
I think that actually it's interesting. Turkey is committed to maintaining its Iran policy, which has been a policy of rapprochement and engagement, despite the change in the Syria policy. And I think that I don't think it's really a zero-sum game. And so far as, for example, it is true that Turkey has ignored Tehran's objections and essentially made it clear that they are going to take a hardline position against Assad if he continues sort of the repression in Syria. But at the same time, Turkey has also, in a number of ways, behaved as an important ally for Iran, and I think Iran values that, especially at a time when it's facing greater isolation. So I think both parties, for a variety of reasons, are seeking to downplay the tensions that now emerge over Syria and focus on the many other ways in which Iran and Turkey now have an actually very cooperative relationship. And I think it's a complicated picture, and I think in the United States we have a tendency of seeing the question in very black and white terms. So Turkey rebuffs Israel, and it's just seen as Turkey's switched axes, and now is in Iran's camp, and everything's Iran's gain. Then Turkey takes a strong position on Syria, and suddenly it's a zero-sum game, and everything's against Iran. And I think neither of those things are true. At no time was this, it's not a policy that's about Iran, but I also think at the same time it's a policy that's calibrated in order to maintain an engaged relationship with Iran. And by the way, Iran itself has been extremely restrained with respect to defense of the Syrian regime. And I think I can only imagine that behind the scenes, the Iranians must be extremely worried about the course that Assad is taking and probably likely placing tremendous pressure on him to reverse course as well. So I'm not sure that they're at cross purposes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Aslan Bali.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Aslan Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and she has a forthcoming article, The Perils of Judicial Independence, an article about Turkey. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with the former Assistant Secretary of State for Chinese Affairs.
If you tell you what, you better think, they come out. If you raise up your hand, you better raise up your clan, fix up, ass up, and think about it, man. But we really wanna fight, yes, me. Really wanna fight, what's it crazy? Really wanna fight, yes, who? Really wanna fight, trust me. Think about it, man. Think before you run, cause you're not get far when you're done. You better call for the law, think you run. You better call me the law, think you run.
And back on the train, this time tomorrow, by foot, wheel, or sail. But this time, no sorrow. First stop, Jackson. Next stop, Shangri-La. And I cannot wait to see the expression on the face of my sweet Lord.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's also a professor of political science at UC San Diego and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And in 1993, founded and continues to lead the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue, an unofficial Track 2 forum for discussions of security issues amongst defense and foreign ministry officials and academics from the United States, Japan, China, Russia, and the Koreas. Her latest book, now in paperback, is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And she has a forthcoming book, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Shirk.
Thank you very much.
And I don't know whether you, the level to which you are masochistic and were watching the recent Republican presidential debate on foreign policy, which was absolutely shockingly replete with gratuitous China bashing. Mm-hmm. But the one exception was the former U.S. ambassador to China, John Huntsman, who actually seemed to say something that I found very interesting, and I suspect it may well be the content or a part of the content in your new book, Changing Media, Changing China. He said that China was poised for a huge generational shift and that there's an extraordinary number of young Chinese who are internet savvy, globally oriented, and that when they come to power, things are going to change radically. Would you agree?
Well, I certainly agree that there's an information revolution underway in China and that people have much more knowledge about what's going on in the outside world as well as what's going on in different parts of the country. And the most media savvy part of the population certainly are the urban, well-educated younger generation. And these folks are increasingly frustrated by the limitations on their access to information, which is very transparent as the propaganda department yanks sensitive stories off the internet. And so the hand of the censor is very visible. So on the other hand, the censor is not winning the contest. And despite censorship, people still do have a lot more information than they used to do in the Mao era, for sure.
So would that mean then that the treatment of the artist Ai Weiwei is in fact a kind of litmus test, or at least a yardstick in this to and fro tension between freedom of speech demanded by the young and control demanded by the Communist Party?
Well, I don't know if I'd say that the Ai Weiwei case is a litmus test, because the treatment of a dissident artist is still kind of an issue that is of concern to a relatively small number of people in China. You know, a kind of artistic intellectual elite. I think there are issues such as how openly to discuss the causes of the high-speed rail crash or food and medicine safety or land requisitions, those kinds of issues of justice and of public safety are probably more salient to more people than the Ai Weiwei case.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who's the was formerly the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. And President Obama's trip to Australia and then on to Indonesia for the APEC summit is in the wake of Secretary Hillary Clinton's announcement of a so-called pivot towards Asia in terms of the Obama administration's new foreign policy doctrine that appears to promise to look towards Asia and China and away from the traditional primary focus on Europe. Let's begin with Australia. The notion that 2,500 Marines is really upsetting China, deployed in Australia, that really upsets China, with given the size of the People's Liberation Army, seems a little ridiculous to me. How do you relate to that firestorm of criticism?
Well, first of all, the Chinese response actually has been
surprisingly mild if you compare it, you know, kind of calibrated with the intensity of anti-American rhetoric about containment. It really hasn't been all that bad. And I think it's because President Obama very carefully said that this is not aimed at China, that we need a place for our Marines to train. The area in Australia offers that space. We're starting off small with just 250. They'll be rotated in. By the way, this is something that we started talking about in the Clinton administration. So it's been under discussion for quite some time. And when he said this is not aimed at China and that we believe maintaining a U.S. military presence in the region is good for everyone, you know, it may be a bit ingenuous because, of course, the rise of China is part of the context of regional security, but I think it enables the Chinese not to respond with too much rhetorical heat.
I suppose I should have been clear there, Susan Shirk, that most of the criticism was within Australia about whether to take this stance and to alienate Australia's biggest trading partner.
Well, I don't think China is going to stop trading with Australia or treat Australia as an enemy. In fact, to the contrary, I think that China will probably intensify its efforts to engage Australia diplomatically and economically.
So in terms of the subsequent meetings in Indonesia, of course, the President Obama, first of all, he is a child of the Pacific, if you will. He was born in Hawaii and spent a number of years in Indonesia. What was your takeaway from the APEC summit?
We had the APEC summit, of course, and then we also had the East Asian summit. So the president has been very busy this week, spending the entire week in Asia, and it's an opportunity for the Obama administration to roll out a new, very active diplomacy in the region of the sort that we've never seen before, frankly, because typically, it's very hard to get our public officials out to Asia because Washington is so far away. This is the tyranny of distance. We want to be an Asia-Pacific power. We want to maintain our presence in the region militarily as well as diplomatically and economically. But it's often hard to do it, and we find ourselves concentrating on traditional diplomacy in Europe or in the wars against terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Asia kind of comes in last place. Well, the Obama administration came into office determined to try to remedy this and to show that we are not marginal players in Asia, that we're there to stay despite our current and hopefully temporary economic difficulties. And I must say, it's been quite, my view is that it's been extraordinarily successful.
Well, one of the things that I find extraordinary, Dr. Susan Shirk, is the extent to which the United States and the punditry, both here and in Europe, has this expectation that somehow China it's appropriate for China to bail out Europe. And you could make the case that that President Obama's re-election fortunes are in the hands of Angela Merkel, in as much as if the European economy tanks, the fallout will affect our economic recovery as anemic as it is, and therefore affect the president's fortunes of being re-elected. But the first question would be, why do we expect this poor country, whose average income, I believe, is something like $6,000 a year, to bail out both, not only to finance our deficit, but to bail out the Europeans?
Well, I think probably because they have these massive foreign exchange reserves, and they therefore do have, as a government, the wherewithal to contribute to a package. And also, people think that China will want to increase its influence in the world and therefore will want to contribute. But in fact, China is quite wary of making a contribution that attracts too much attention. If they thought that joining in an international effort such as through the IMF would really be helpful in bolstering the economies in Europe, and of course Europe is China's greatest, largest trading partner, so that's pretty important to them, I think they would want to do it. But what they don't want to do is to have a benevolent action of trying to help Europe just feed into perceptions that China is becoming so powerful and therefore that it's a threat.
And what about the notion of the president's vulnerability vis-a-vis Europe? Do you agree with that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, the state of the U.S. economy during this election campaign is one of the most important, if not the important factor in what the outcome will be, and therefore to the extent that our economy is tied to the troubles in Europe, certainly it matters a great deal.
So in your book, China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise, Susan Shirk, you made the case that our continually overstating China's this great juggernaut that is taking over the world. You're saying, well, wait a minute. You know, the Chinese leadership are always looking over their shoulder at the extraordinary changes within the country, the division between the inland and the coast, and now, of course, the difference, the disparity in wealth in China is starting to approach the disparity of wealth here in the United States.
No, so it surpassed it, actually.
It has surpassed it. Well, so you know, it is China appears to be in a state of such transition. I don't know. Give us an update on that dynamic, whether the fears of the West are overstated and the internal divisions are growing.
Well, China's leaders are incredibly insecure and nervous about domestic threats to their power. That's been the case, especially since Tiananmen in 1989, when party rule almost ended, in, of course, the same year that the Berlin Wall fell and the communist rule in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe began to disintegrate. So they are very nervous about internal threats, and they continue to be so. Each generation of leadership has less of a personal prestige and following, from Mao to Deng Xiaoping to Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao and now to Xi Jinping. So, but I think that internal weakness actually is a risk from the standpoint of peace and security of the United States and of China's Asian neighbors, because what could happen is that China's leaders might feel compelled to make verbal threats, even backed up by some military exercises, toward Taiwan or toward Japan or even possibly toward the South China Sea, because domestic nationalism has grown so strong and is stimulated by the media and the Internet. So for China's leaders to defend themselves and to maintain their domestic popularity, they may be tempted to make threats that they feel they can't back down from without losing their power at home. And that's one reason I do think it's very important to have a strong U.S. military presence in the region, so that when China's leaders are tempted to make those threats, they look out over the water and they see the risks of doing so.
Just in the last minute, or less than a minute, Susan Shirk, the battle, if you will, between the kind of Communist Party of China, which is in many ways resembles a kind of mafia organization, and the emerging government, rule of law kind of agencies that they're trying to create, where does that stand?
Well, unfortunately, political reform has really stalled out. There's been no progress in political reform, and I'd say no progress in economic reform for the past 10 years or more. The court system continues to be under the thumb of the Communist Party. So China's leaders have adopted normatively the ideal of rule of law, but they certainly haven't realized it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Susan Shirk.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Shirk, who's the director of the University of California System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's also a professor of political science at UC San Diego and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And in 1993, founded and continues to lead the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue, an unofficial Track 2 forum for discussions on security issues amongst defense and foreign ministry officials and academics from the United States, Japan, China, Russia, and the Koreas. Her latest book now in paperback is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise, and she has a forthcoming book, Changing Media, Changing China. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the former congressman, now head of Common Cause, Bob Edgar, talking about the super committee deadlocking and the extent to which the whole thing has been kind of kabuki theater. The super committee came about because of the economic hostage crisis, where the Republicans essentially threatened to destroy the good faith and credit of the United States government if they didn't get their way. And as a compromise, they came up with this idea of seven members from both sides coming up with a deal with a gun to their head. If they didn't reach $1.2 trillion in cuts, the trigger would be pulled and we'd have automatic cuts. Well, guess what? They haven't agreed. They're not going to agree. And the trigger won't happen because they've got about a year to weasel their way out of it. Bob Edgar also talked about the Stock Act story, about how the Congress is free to do insider trading, and they're all making a lot of them are making a ton of money on the stock exchange. Whether the outrage over the 60 Minutes piece will provoke and will force them to look at the Stock Act, he thought that was a possibility. But again, he felt that the real issue was getting rid of Citizens United. I spoke with Asla Bali after that. She's a specialist on Turkey, and we talked about Turkey's growing and assertive role in the Middle East and how much they're pushing for the end of the Assad regime in Syria and how valuable and important they'll be in stabilizing a post-Assad Syria. A lot of interesting inside information about the Turkish leader and about the relations with Israel. And then finally, I spoke with Susan Shirk, the former Assistant Secretary of State in charge of Asia and Chinese affairs. We talked about President Obama's trip to Australia and to the APEC summit. Her basic point is that the Chinese leadership's real focus is on internal matters. They're looking over their shoulder, hoping the whole place doesn't fall apart, while we think of them as this great unstoppable juggernaut. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.